Looks like staying fine and dry through the day. A chilly start, but then we'll see some sunshine and temperatures reaching 15 degrees in Stornoway. Through Wednesday nights, we'll see the wind strengthening in the southwest. And by Thursday, we could have gales in parts of the south, gusts of 50 to 60 miles per hour, with some further spells of rain. Well, that's all for now. It's back to you, Alan.
Thanks, Ben. Now on Radio 4, it's time for our Book of the Week. Professor Dave Goulson explores the extraordinary feats of the bumblebee, including their ability to navigate and how they choose exactly which flowers to visit. As a small boy, however, he was obsessed with wildlife, and living in the Shropshire countryside, he was able to indulge two fairly gruesome childhood passions, dissection and taxidermy. Tim McInerney reads part two of A Sting in the Tail.
When I was 9 years old, I became interested in how animals worked and decided to investigate what they looked like on the inside. Thinking back, I wonder at my parents' indulgence, for I took to collecting roadkill and dissecting the remains of a variety of mangled beasts in our back garden. I persuaded my grandparents to buy me a dissecting kit for my birthday. I've no idea now what I said I wanted it for, but I very much doubt that I told them I wanted to chop up dead and squashed animals. On my birthday, the dissecting kit arrived, and it was marvellous, containing lethally sharp scalpels of various shapes and sizes, a selection of pointed probes, delicate scissors, and a lovely little chrome hand lens, all rolled up in a soft cloth pouch. I boosted its contents by persuading my Uncle Ed, a chiropodist from Norwich, to give me some extra instruments, including some wickedly curved scalpel blades used for carving ingrowing toenails, or bunions, or some such. My mother had a copy of Gray's Anatomy, and although it describes human anatomy, I used it to identify the various organs in animals, many of which look surprisingly similar in small mammals, and even in birds. I managed to get hold of some formaldehyde and used it to pickle some of the more interesting body parts in jam jars, which I arranged on the shelves in my bedroom. From dissection, it was a short but inevitable move to taxidermy. My first specimen was a black-headed gull. Feeding bread to the ducks on the lake at Ellesmere one day, I noticed one particular gull which was unable to fly, so I caught it, took it home, and attempted to nurse it back to health. By dawn, it was dead. It seemed a perfect candidate for my first taxidermy attempt. The principles of taxidermy are very simple. The body is sliced open in a neat line running from the bottom of the tail to the base of the neck. The skin is then peeled back and the carcass pulled out, turning the skin inside out. Three stiff wires, mother's cannibalized coat hangers, are then pushed through the body. One protrudes on either side for attachment to the wing bones or forelegs. The second is sharply curved and pushed into the underside so that both ends point downwards for attachment to the back legs. The final one is shorter and is pushed into the top of the body where the neck would naturally attach. Only one end is left protruding, onto which the skull is impaled. The skin is then rolled back over the skull, stretched over the new body, and the legs and wing bones attached to the appropriate wire with more cotton. The skin is sewn back up and voila! One has a perfect replica of the original animal. Or at least that is the theory. In my gull, the wings slanted upwards at an awkward angle, one leg was turned sideways, and various feathers stuck up at unexpected angles. The overall effect was of a bird that had just received a large electric shock. My efforts to stuff other animals were no more successful. I found a ferret dead in a snare and deployed my limited skills once more. This time the skin shrank so badly that I had to make the body incredibly narrow to stretch the skin around it. It also smelled spectacularly awful. Live ferrets smell bad enough, but a dead one defies description. It was soon consigned to the garage by order of my mum. I came across a wood pigeon which had been stamped on by a bad-tempered horse. The back end was damaged, but the front, with its beautiful iridescent neck feathers, was fine. My solution was to mount the head and neck on a small piece of plywood and hang it on the wall. The result of this new obsession was that my bedroom was now adorned with a myriad of nightmarishly deformed creatures. These days, I must admit that I'm not enormously fond of the pestilential flocks of feral pigeons that infest many city centres, but nonetheless, they are capable of truly amazing feats of navigation. Imagine, you are locked in a dark box, transported for hours over 200 miles from home in a random, unknown direction, and then asked to find your own way back. With barely a moment's hesitation, the pigeon sets off flying at a brisk pace in precisely the correct direction. A few hours later, it is happily perched in its loft, tucking into a tasty bowl of grain. How on earth does it do this? Despite many years of scientific research, we still have not fully understood how pigeons navigate home so expertly from places that they have never previously visited. In the late 1990s, I couldn't resist investigating the navigation abilities of bumblebees. I set up 5 buff-tailed bumblebee nests in boxes in my garden. When I first opened the doors, the bees poured out, eager to explore their new environment. The air filled with hovering, circling bees, but within a few minutes they had all disappeared off into the surrounding gardens, where they happily began foraging, returning a little later with balls of pollen on their legs and stomachs full of honey. Once the bees were experienced, which took some only an hour or two, they whizzed off purposefully and disappeared at high speed. When the bees had had a week to settle down, I began my homing trials. I caught them as they left their nest to forage and glued a tiny coloured and numbered disc to each of their backs so that I could recognise them again. I then placed them individually in small cardboard pots and drove them in my car to a random location. I would stop by the roadside and release a batch of 10 bees, noting down their numbers. Invariably, and understandably, they looked rather confused at this point, and would usually circle about in much the same way as they had when they first left their nest. Some would head straight to the nearest flowers for a quick drink after the hot journey in the car. Within a few minutes, all had disappeared into the distance. At this point, I would jump back into the car and race for home, where I would sit and wait for the bees to return. The record distance over which a bee successfully returned to the nest was 10 kilometres. I was very proud of Blue 36. It took her 2 days to get home. White 15 was released next to a nice patch of borage flowers in the grounds of Chilworth Manor, about 3 kilometres from my house. Borage produces particularly large amounts of sweet nectar, which bumblebees love. White 15 was one of the clever bees that made her way home successfully and swiftly, but to my amazement, on subsequent days, she went back to the borage flowers. Every evening she was in her nest in my garden, but she would spend her days repeating the 6 kilometre round trip to Chilworth over and over again to collect nectar. Blue 36's feat is equivalent to a man being taken about 1,600,000 kilometres from home and managing to find his way back again under his own power. This is more than 4 times the distance to the moon. White 15's repeated journey to Chilworth to collect food is the equivalent of a man circumnavigating the globe 10 times just to get to the shops, and then having to come back again, several times a day. So how did Blue 36 make it back from 10 kilometres away? Our best guess is that in their exploratory flights, bees learn the relative positions of landmarks, just as they memorise objects close to the entrance to their nest, mentally logging the locations of tall trees, buildings, fence posts, and so on. It seems likely that when I released bumblebees in strange locations, they looped out from their place of release in search of familiar landmarks. If they were lucky enough to find one, they would quickly be able to get home. Given the huge amount of energy that a bumblebee needs to fly, their ability to navigate accurately and swiftly between flower patches and their nest is the key to their survival. In the summer of 1996, I found myself watching bumblebees while sitting amidst a dense patch of nettles and comfrey in the Itchen Valley Country Park. I had noticed that comfrey flowers, both there and elsewhere, are very variable in colour. Some are white, others pale mauve, dark purple, and just occasionally bright pink. I was curious to find out whether different insects preferred particular colours. Comfrey flowers are quite deep, so that only long-tongued bumblebees, such as the garden bumblebee and the common carder, can reach the nectar, but I noticed that white-tailed and buff-tailed bumblebees, which are short-tongued, would readily bite a hole in the side of the flower and steal the nectar, something known as nectar robbing. If I listened closely, I could actually hear their jaws chomping through the petal. It dawned on me that I had been seeing something else that was very odd, although it had nothing to do with the colour of the flowers. Dozens of bees were buzzing around in the comfrey patches, flitting swiftly from flower to flower. Very often they would fly up to a flower, hover in front of it, but then fly away without landing. They might do this to three or four flowers before finding one that was apparently to their taste. Then they would land and feed. To try to find out what was going on, I measured the nectar in these rejected flowers. This is a fiddly business. The usual approach is to use a very narrow glass tube, which is carefully pushed into the flower in exactly the way in which a bee inserts its tongue, so that the tip of the tube touches the tiny drop of nectar at the bottom of the flower. When this happens, the nectar is sucked into the tube all on its own, due to something known as capillary action. I measured the nectar in hundreds of the flowers that the bees rejected. It turned out that those flowers that were being ignored had less nectar in them than the flowers the bees landed on. Somehow they could tell which flowers had the most rewards and were avoiding landing on those that didn't have much in them. I realized that the bees must somehow be able to tell which flowers had recently been visited by another bee. Regardless of whether it was full or empty, bees would not land upon a flower recently visited by another. Perhaps they could smell where other bees had previously been. We tried washing the feet of bees with a tiny drop of solvent, then pipetting the drops onto flowers. And hey presto, those flowers were rejected by other bees. If we pipetted only solvent onto the flowers, there was no effect. So it turns out that bees leave behind a smelly footprint when they land, which any subsequent passers-by can detect, alerting them to the fact that the flower has recently been emptied. It seems that different flower species refill with nectar at different rates. For example, borage produces nectar very fast, whereas comfrey is middling and birdsfoot trefoil is very slow. When feeding on borage, bees start revisiting a flower just 2 minutes after the previous visit. And again, this roughly corresponds with the time it takes to refill. So it seems that bumblebees are able to tell how old a footprint is, perhaps by the strength of the smell. This is helped by the fact that individual bees tend to specialise for several days at a time, and sometimes for their entire life, in visiting just one flower species over and over again. So a bee visiting borage quickly learns to ignore all but the freshest smelly footprint, while a bee visiting birdsfoot trefoil learns that a flower that smells even faintly of another bee's feet is best avoided. Interestingly, the same smelly footprints, when encountered in a different context, have a different meaning. Bee footprints around the entrance to the nest, rather than having a repellent effect, help returning foragers to find their way inside. It seems that bumblebees learn to interpret a particular smell in an appropriate way, depending on the circumstances in which they encounter it. It is humbling to reflect that though a bumblebee has a brain smaller than a grain of rice, it has powers of perception and learning that often put us mammals to shame. Next time you're sitting in your garden while the bees are visiting your bee-friendly plants, take time to watch what they are doing. You will quickly notice them dismissing some flowers after a quick sniff. Bumblebees are one of the most familiar and intensively studied of all the insects on Earth, but there is still an enormous amount that we do not understand about their lives.
Episode 2 of The Sting in the Tail by Dave Goulson was read by Tim McInerney. It was abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Wednesday the 8th of May. There are warnings of gales in Fitzroy, Seoul, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon and Rockall. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Seoul 998, expected Rockall 984 by 1800 Wednesday. Low Shannon 1001, losing its identity by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s, Cromarty. Easterly or southeasterly, 4 or 5, increasing 6 or 7 for a time in South Utsira. Fog patches, rain later, moderate or good, occasionally very poor. Fourth, Tyne, Dogger. Southeast, veering south later, 4 or 5, occasionally 6. Showers, fog patches, moderate.